Matthew chapter 5, we're going to be verse 21 to 26. If you came up to me and you asked me the following question, Michael, are you an angry person? This would be my answer. No. In fact, I don't think most of the people who are with me would say that guy's life is defined by anger. I don't think our staff would say that. I don't think my friends would say that. Like, I'm a pretty lighthearted, jovial guy. I mean, I can be pretty serious and intense, right? And I've gotten angry at a number of people in my life for sure. Some of you have gotten angry at me. Some of us have gotten angry at each other. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're an angry person, right? And I would probably say I have moments of anger, but it doesn't really define me. It doesn't really define my relationships. And so until a couple years ago, my daughter, who is about 4, almost 5, she had a conversation with my wife. Now, this conversation was so striking and embarrassing that I decided to make sure I documented it word for word. So at the time, my 4-year-old, almost 5-year-old daughter comes up to my wife and says, "How about we get Dad a book for his birthday?" Okay, intrigued, my wife says, "What book would you like to get him?" She says, "An adult book on parenting." All right, cool, all right. "What do you want Daddy to learn?" my wife says, and here's her response. "How to get mad and not yell." Mere guilty, right? And I'd love to say, that was just a season, right? And all of you are like, glad I'm not Michael right now, wouldn't want to have to say that. Guilty, right? You know what I'm talking about. But in that moment, I realized that anger is real. It's in me. Yeah, I tame it a lot, but it's there. And sometimes it's just under the surface. And sometimes the safest, right environments expose that. And in that moment, my daughter became to me a mirror. And she showed me the true state of my heart. And this is really what Jesus is going to do with anger and a number of other issues in the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount, it's going to be a mirror. And he's going to put the mirror up to your heart, and he's going to make you stare your true self in the face. And I'm going to be honest, it's gut-wrenching. If you read the Sermon on the Mount, or if you listen to the Sermon on the Mount, and you walk away thinking, I'm a good person, you are not paying attention at all. Like, you have completely 100% missed the point of what Jesus is trying to get at, which one of the major points of the Sermon on the Mount, by the way, is you are not a good person. You are a lawbreaker, right? That's going to be one of the most important things that he wants everyone in this room, myself included, to understand. You're not good. You are a lawbreaker. And the second thing he wants to do is show you, but there is a better way. And so what Jesus is going to do is he's going to take one of the Ten Commandments after another. He's going to go through a handful of them, and he's going to show them that they are actually breaking every single one of the Ten Commandments. These people who thought, I'm a good person, I follow the Ten Commandments, what he's going to show them is, actually, you're not a good person, and you're breaking all of them, and you're guilty before God, but there's good news, there's a better way. And so if you read the Sermon on the Mount, and you think you're a good person, I'm just going to tell you, you're not really hearing exactly what Jesus is saying. Now, there's an accusation in the Sermon on the Mount toward Jesus that he is responding to. He's defending himself. And the accusation might go something like this. Jesus wants to destroy the law and create anarchy and chaos. Like, that was the concern that the Jewish and religious leaders had, and they were spreading these messages, even though this is the very beginning of Jesus' earthly ministry, he's already having to defend himself against lies and slander about his true motivations and intentions. And is Jesus here to get rid of and destroy and abolish the law? And the answer is no. In fact, what Jesus wants to tell them is destroy the law. I am here to obey every single letter of this law. And unlike you guys, I'm going to obey it from the heart, not just externally. I'm going to obey it from the very core of who I am with joy. Jesus isn't here to abolish it. But here you're going to find Jesus is having to defend himself. So open up your notes with me. Point number one in your app or your sermon notes is, my anger incriminates me. Verse 21, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment." So he's trying to make a case. You're not good. So what does he do? He pulls out the Ten Commandments, the basis for which they all think they're good people. And he says, can we all just agree for a moment that this is a good commandment? You shall not murder. And the answer everybody is, Is that good? Yes, awesome. And if you murder, here's the punishment under a Jewish court. You would be killed. Your life would be taken from you. This is a tribal society. They did not have an incarceration system that was of any benefit whatsoever. And so here's what would happen. You murder somebody. Life is so valuable that your life will cease to exist from this point forward. And so they all agreed. If you kill somebody, all right, we're on the same page. And then he says in verse 22, but I say to you. And as he says this, don't you feel like he's going to contradict the law for a moment? He's not going to do that. He's actually going to double down on the law. And here's what he says, and I want you to pay attention in verse 22. You're going to see the word my brother in purple, okay? It's going to come up throughout the message. And I want you to do is in the margin of your mind over here, just take mental note of this word every time it comes up. And at the end of the sermon, I'm going to bring this thing full circle. Sound good? So here's what we find, verse 22. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with who? His brother, will be liable to judgment. Okay, I can imagine they say, some lawyer says, Jesus, the law does not give you permission to prosecute intent. The law gives you permission to prosecute a violation that you have acted on that is measurable. That's what the law gives you the freedom to do. And at this point, what Jesus is going to build to throughout the Sermon on the Mount, throughout his teachings, is that you're right. On a human level, the Jewish courts have limitations. They cannot prosecute intent. But there is a court that is higher than the Jewish court. And it is the court where Jesus Christ, who is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords and the Judge of the universe, will judge all people. And I want you to hear me. He is smarter than all the justices of the Jewish court. He has the authority to judge the intentions and the desires of the heart. Now, isn't that scary? That should be petrifying to a degree here. I want to read to you Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12 and 13. Now, automatically, there's a hurdle to overcome with almost everybody in this room. If you have been in church for more than a month, okay, you've probably heard a pastor or somebody teach on this verse. And it starts off and it says, for the word of God, okay? And immediately you are conditioned to believe this is what? The Bible, okay? But in John 1:1, what is the word of God? Jesus. And I'm gonna make a strong contention, and I think the text is with 100% certainty gonna validate what I'm gonna say to you. This is not talking about the Bible at all. This is talking about Jesus. So here's what he says. For the word of God is living and active. Let me give you a real-time like translation or interpretation. He's not dead. He's not inactive. It's not some deist version of God that created the earth, wound it up like a clock, and walked away and let it tick on. He is very active and engaged in the affairs of this world. He's living and he's active and he's sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow. It's also discerning. Last time I checked, an inanimate object like a word or a book or a written word cannot discern. People discern. Well, here's what it discerns. Not just what you do, but the thoughts and the intentions of what? The heart. Well, it goes on. And now this word of God is personified. No creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom, do you see that this is not about an inanimate object, this is about a person, Jesus Christ, the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. And here's the reality. The Jewish law can only prosecute murder. But in God's law, he prosecutes the entire train of thought and emotional sequence that leads up to it. So let's just take a moment. Let's forget about Old Testament law for a moment because none of you are under it. The majority of you are not Jewish. Let's talk about something that scholars, theologians call the moral law. And this is actually a category that the Apostle Paul speaks to. The moral law is this universal sense of right and wrong, good and bad, that God has infused on the conscience and the heart and the mind of every person that has ever lived in the entire world. The moral law is like gravity. Everywhere you go, there you find it. Okay? It does not matter what generation, what millennia, what century, where you are on the world, whether it's a small tribal group across the world or it's an empire in the Middle East 2,000 years ago, everywhere you go, you're going to find that there's this thing called the moral law, this sense, this intrinsic sense of right and wrong that God has put on the hearts and minds of everybody. Again, it's like gravity. And here's what you find, that everywhere you go, This law exists, and almost every single person in the world even violates the moral law. Now, let's just carry this out. Verse 22, we're going to watch as this unfolds, and I want you to keep this category of moral law in your mind. He says that everyone who is angry with who? His brother will be liable to judgment. And whoever insults who? His brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, "You fool," will be liable to the hell of fire. He takes this beyond just the Jewish courts, and he says, let me tell you the standard by which God himself will judge on the day of judgment. The command on a human level is do not murder, but God is not just simply concerned with what you do, he is concerned with who you are. Sin is sin before God, whether it is acted on or it is inside of you and invisible and a secret. And so there are two things that make you guilty before God, not the Jewish human law, but before God, of breaking the murder commandment. And the first one is this: anger of your heart. Anybody experience this? Let's just call it unrighteous anger. I'll just put my hand up here. Like, there is a lot of moments in my life where there are feels that I feel and I don't tell people about it because I don't want anybody to know about it. And they are not okay. They are not righteous. They are not good. They are not holy. And if those things were verbalized, they would be of no benefit to anybody but would make me just look like a terrible person. And from what I understand, the majority of you have this also. But there's a second level. Anger expressed with your mouth makes you, in God's divine court, guilty of murder. Now, you may not like this, but this is the divine law that God is orchestrating here. Now, he says this: even if you do these, you will be guilty of hell. Does that feel like a powerful statement? Like, this is a serious threat. What Jesus is trying to get to is say, you might not have physically taken someone's life, but you are just as guilty because the very core and basis of that infraction is inside of your heart. And by the way, God cares just as much about your heart as he does what you do. Hell here is a reference to the Hinnom Valley. It's just southwest of Jerusalem. And former kings would practice human, especially human infant sacrifice in this place. And Jesus' day was called the Valley of Slaughter. And it was a garbage dump. It was this perpetual fire that would just keep going and going. And so when Jesus wanted to give a point of reference to judgment in hell, he points over to the Hinnom Valley. Literally, this is the Gehenna of hell. And he points to this. And at this point, here's what you're going to be thinking if you are at least a little rebellious or like resistant even to Jesus. Michael, Jesus, I'm not an angry person. I am better than that. There are people that are worse for me. Let me introduce to some of you. Some of you, this is an old game. The anger spectrum. I love the anger spectrum. Because what the anger spectrum does is it helps you realize that anger is not just one singular emotion. It starts all the way at the beginning stages with something like irritation. It's that little thing inside of you. You're like, eh, and you do a really good job. Some of you, most of you don't, a really good job of trying to hide your irritation. But irritation grows to frustration. It gets a little bit more interesting. It's a little bit more perpetual. It's not just momentary, but it's like irritation after irritation turns into frustration. And then it's aggravation. Has your spouse ever said, like have you ever said to your spouse, "I'm aggravated"? Like, you're on the verge of anger, right? And then when you're like, "I'm angry," like, this is a different category, isn't it? Like, when you say I'm aggravated versus I'm angry. But then something happens with anger. Anger that is untamed, anger that is unchecked, comes alive and has profound negative impact in your life. It grows into bitterness. It's this ugly, dark vice that is so sinister inside of you, and it starts to kill you from the inside out one moment after another. And then what happens is malice. Malice is intent to harm, intent to wrath. And malice is not always physical, by the way. Malice is when you sit in the bathroom and you turn over, or in your bed or in the shower or by yourself or you're driving, over and over and over in your head. If I could just say this to them, if they could replay that moment, if I had another chance, I'd sock them in the face. If I could have my way with them, I'd use this word and that word, and when I get to talk to them, you know that feeling? Anyone? Again, am I the only guilty one in this room? Right? That's malice, okay? Wrath is the pouring out of your anger, where in unrighteousness, you decide to take your own vengeance and punishment verbally, physically, or otherwise. Now, do you start to see how you are actually angry? We're gonna continue to double down on this. Anger is like pregnancy. That's funny. My wife was in the first service, thank God. All right. No, but it's quiet at first. You can't see it. Someone in our church was pregnant for a month and didn't even know it. That's awesome, right? So sometimes you don't even know it's there. right? And then you start, a whole trimester. I was like, wow, you're pregnant for a whole trimester. That's amazing. And then it starts to show, right? It starts to show, and eventually it's going to come out of you. It has one destination. It has one trajectory, right? Did I say something inappropriate? Okay, just making sure. In my head, there was nothing, but it might have happened. Just want to make sure we're on the same page. So there are two words for anger in the Greek New Testament. Just get our heads around this. The first is thumos. Thumos is this irritation, this aggravation. It starts to grow, but it's mostly internal. It's reactive, different things like that, okay? But thumos untamed turns into what's called orge. And orge is the word where we would get our word orgy from. It's this idea of passionate, and it is unrestrained, and it's over the top, and it's not okay, and there's something malicious about it. You can see on the spectrum how thumos ultimately turns into orge. There's just a natural progression of anger. And so the Greeks kind of had two different words to categorize this. Are you in thumos or orge? And so they start to understand that, look, there's a point where anger is fine, right? God, anger is a righteous emotion. It is from God. God gets angry and he doesn't sin. Ephesians says, be angry and do not sin. But there's a point where your anger is not just unrighteous internally, but it becomes to act out externally. And this is where it becomes orge. This is where it becomes unhealthy and it violates and hurts people all around you. And again, this can be verbal. It can be emotional, passive-aggressive, aggressive, or physical. And here's what I think the Greek words tell us is that your orge, when you get to these places, it originates from untamed thumos. That there's something about the Christian experience that when you experience thumos, our requirement as followers of Jesus is to tame this and to release it. An anger that if it's not tamed, it grows and it has a necessary outcome and eventually it gives birth to wrath. Now, I want to just take a moment because there's going to be some of you in this room and you're like, okay, I've gotten angry at times. I do see that there's anger in me. And here is your retort to me. Pastor Michael, I am a good person. Okay? I get it. You believe, and there are many people who believe to the core of their being that they are a good person. I would like the honor and the privilege to try to prove to you that you're a terrible human being. Ready? Okay, so I want to do this, and I want to just show you the good person law. So it doesn't matter to me if you are a Muslim, if you are a Jew, if you're a Hindu, if you're a Christian. If you were to be judged by the law you claim to follow, I would like to tell you this. You are guilty of the laws that you claim to follow. You are flat out guilty. And you're not just sort of guilty, you are really guilty. Okay? And you're thinking, no, Michael, I'm a good person. So here's the good person law. The mantra of good people everywhere is this. Ready? Good people go to heaven. I'm a good person. This is like the core conviction. If you want more on this, we dismantled this entire lie last week in last week's sermon. So how does a good person self-define and know without a shadow of a doubt that they are a good person? Well, they take the good person test. This isn't a joke. Like, this is literally subconsciously how people process this. All you have to do is ask people, how do you know you're a good person? And they're going to give you two fundamental answers. And here's the first answer. They're going to answer this question in the affirmative. Am I better than the bad people in my life, especially the ones on TV? That literally, like when you ask people, how do you know you're a good person? Well, I'm not as bad as, and they pick out a TV personality. And then inevitably, if you keep probing, they'll start to find a couple really terrible people in their life. And so this is actually the first metric by which people determine that I'm a good person. And so here's the second question that they have to answer in an affirmative. Do some people perceive me as kind and good? And they'll say, well, of course, everybody doesn't think I'm kind and good, but there's God, like this person does? And I'm like, yeah, but you've known them for a week and they actually don't know you. Do the people who live with you think that you are a kind and good person? But this is how the American justifies themselves. I'm a good person. I'm not as bad as the people on TV. I'm better than most of the people in my life. And Jimmy, Bob, and Billy Sue, they think I'm good. Therefore, I'm good. Now, I'd like to take the moment just to dismantle this for a moment. I know that there's going to be, and so you might be listening online, you might be in this room, and you're thinking, that guy's a jerk. Trust me, I want to give you a big hug. I want to go eat a meal with you and just hang out, okay? But as a preacher, we have to honestly proclaim what God's word says. So I want to just try to help you understand this, why you're going to fail the good person test every single time. So I want you to think through, your bitterness, your secrets, your judgmentalism, all the people you did not help, but you should have, all the people you didn't encourage, but should have, all the people you discouraged, but shouldn't have, and maybe the people that you shouldn't have helped, but you did. I think that's going to get a lot of you. All the things you did when you were younger, hear me, you tell yourself that doesn't count anymore because enough time passed and now you're absolved. Says who? The good person law. Think of all the people you avoided but you should have loved. All the times you gossiped or even the times you just listened to gossip. All the people that you should have talked to about Jesus and did not. Now let's talk about things that are close to the heart of God. Think about the time in God's word you neglected. The money you didn't tithe. Drop the mic, walk away. The amount of times you didn't go to church, but you should have. The times you went to church, but weren't really here. The times you sang and didn't mean it. The ministry you committed to serve, but bailed out on. The ministry you served in, but were half-hearted and on your phone most of the time. The white lies, the arguments with your spouse, the arguments with your kids, the arguments with your parents, the resentment towards your neighbors, the conflict you have not dealt with, the passivity in you, your aggression, your passive aggression, okay, your insecurity, your overcompensation. I could just go on. And let me be clear, that's my list, okay? That's my list. And here's what I know. The majority of you, you can relate to the majority of things on that list. And you know what? I haven't even begun to scratch the surface of your hypocrisy. The very laws you claim, the goodness you claim, you dig down. I'm just here to tell you, anecdotally, you're not good people. And I am not a good person. And the only way that I can declare myself to be a good person is to hide the inner parts and secrets of my life with the hopes that the good God who gives us a good test and lets good people go to heaven doesn't care about what happens on the inside. I'm really banking on the good person test that there is no metric for what happens in my mind and my heart, my souls, or my desires, or my youth. Which brings us to the good person problem. We're just not good. And I love when I have a hunch and scripture affirms what I'm saying. Here's what Romans 3 says. As it is written, none is righteous. And I love how the Apostle Paul like anticipates like objection and he says, no. I hear your thought, but no, not one. No one understands and no one seeks for God. Do you know why you seek for God? Because he sought you first. That's it. That's it. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. And together they have become worthless or useless. No one does good. But there's got to be some. No, not even one. Like, is there any confusion about what God's trying to communicate to us through this? So here's one of the things Jesus is trying to do. You may not have murdered, but God judges the heart. And if you judge in the heart, you're damned. And if you're under the moral law, I'm sorry. The Old Testament religious law, sorry. The good person law, sorry. You've got no righteousness. You're not good. And honestly, this is one of the hardest lies to dismantle. Because if we're not good, and if there is something after this, we know we're not getting in. That's petrifying. And so most people double down. They need the good person law to be true, and they need to be seen as a good person in their own mind. Number two, their anger is an opportunity. So I want us to watch as Jesus shows us a better way, but there's something really interesting that if you're just reading this quickly, you know how sometimes when we read the Bible, it's like a task, right? And we just got to get through it, and our Bible plan says, I got to read a whole chapter today, and you just got other things to do. You know that feeling? This is one of those moments where you just kind of need to stop because there's something missing here. And I think Jesus' audience, here's what they want to say. And the reason I think this is because it's what I want to say to me if I was preaching. Okay, Michael, I'm angry. What do I do with my anger? Right? Anybody want to know that? He passes right by it. And he says, we're not going to talk about your anger. We're going to talk about their anger. And I want you to understand why this is happening. So over the last 2,000 years, every generation of Christians has this doctrine or this thing, this drum that they beat, that they're really, really, really passionate about. And it seems to consume like all of their writing and all of their preaching and all of their thinking, like there's these big drums, right? So you go back to like the fourth century, it was the sacraments. You kept hearing about the sacraments over and over again. You go to the Reformation, which happened in the 16th century. They were just beating the drum of the purity of the gospel over and over. Martin Luther, John Calvin, the list goes on and on. For the Puritans, the drum that they beat over and over again was holiness, holiness, holiness. Like every generation of Christians has this drum that they beat. In the 20th century fundamentalists, it was alcohol or the King James Version or no dancing or whatever rules they could make up, right? And so like they had their drums that they beat, right? And then the liberals, right? It's every liberal sermon you go to, it's social justice, social justice, social justice. It's the only drum that they beat over and over again. And over the last 20 years, if you look at what feels like the vast majority of books in evangelical Christianity, they're getting back to this Reformation, purity of the gospel, purity of the gospel. Everywhere you go, gospel, gospel, gospel. There's this drum that Christians tend to beat all at the same time. Well, I want to take you back to the first century, and I want to tell you one of the major drums that got beat over and over and over again, and often we don't notice it because it's not a high value for us. But if you start reading the New Testament through this lens, you start to see that this is a very common theme. It is a beat, it is an emphasis, it is a focus that is so strong. And here it is, unity. And the greatest threat to their unity is not from out there. It is from in here. It is amongst us. And it is our untamed orgē at one another. That is it. So as elders, we can deal with the lies and doctrinal errors that come into our church. We can start to protect people from untruths and different things like that. But can I tell you one of the most difficult things that a group of pastors and elders will ever get our heads and hearts and hands around? It is unresolved anger and conflict amongst the people of God, which makes us impotent. It is this issue of division and people frustrated with each other. It is the greatest threat internally to our being effective for the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so here is the understanding, if you were a follower of Jesus in the first century, if you're angry, kill it. You just get rid of it. So the preacher in the 21st century would get up and he would say something like this, that's me. Everyone's angry, we totally get it, I know it's hard, let's overcome. The preacher of the first century would get up and say, no. You go get before the Lord and you kill it now, because if you give it an inch, it'll take a mile. You do not let this thing live. The moment you have orgē in your life, you tame it, you control it, and you release it. We have no further discussion on this, I think is what Jesus would say. If you're gonna follow me, there is no space for your bitterness, your malice, or your wrath. If they do something to you, you turn the cheek. Do you start to see how the teachings of Jesus are killing at its very core this issue of anger living? Here's the question Jesus actually wants to train his people on. You already know what to do with your anger. Release it. Let it go. Here's the real question. What do you do when they're angry at you? How do you preserve unity when they are the ones who are angry at you? Hebrews 12, 14, you'll see this theme come out. Strive for peace with who? Everyone. Why is peace so important? Why is this experience of unity and oneness with each other so valuable? Without which no one will see the Lord. You could translate this, interpret this in one of two ways. Without which the Lord will not move in your midst, or without which you will not ultimately see God, your salvation may not be real or true. He says, see to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. Here, hear me. That no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. Do you see this emphasis? Do not let one ounce of thumos turn into orgē. You just kill it and you put it to death. One author wrote this, I love this. Of the seven deadly sins, anger is possibly the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue the prospect of bitter confrontation still to come, to savor to the last toothsome morsel both the pain you are given and the pain you are giving back. In many ways, it's a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. Here's what Jesus knows. Your anger produces nothing of benefit to other people by and large. Kill it. Kill it. Here's the way Jesus' brother James says it. Understand this, my dear brothers and sisters. You must be quick to listen, slow to speak. Slow to what? Get angry. And then he says this. Human anger does not produce the righteousness God desires. Let me just show you what this means. You're angry at somebody. What do you want for them in that moment? Do you want their righteousness? Do you want their Christ-likeness? Then hear me. 99.867% of the time, your anger will not produce that effect. It won't. Because sinful anger will never produce it. And maybe you're the small percentage of people that your anger is righteous, and then that may produce righteousness. But by and large, almost every single anger encounter you have does not produce righteousness, but discouragement and condemnation. So here's the deal. If you're going to act out in anger to somebody, you are pursuing to dismantle Christ in them. That's what you're pursuing. But that is not what we want, is it? And this is why James, brother of Jesus, is like, get rid of thumos and orge. Do not give it life. Don't let it take its natural trajectory, because it destroys this unity that is so precious to Jesus. Okay, so what do Christ followers do with the orge of others? I know what to do with my orge. Get rid of it, kill it, let it go. Verse 23. So if you're offering your gift at the altar. So where's the altar? Jerusalem. The Sermon on the Mount was likely given in Galilee. It's about a 3 days journey if you're in shape, okay? So how far away are they? It's like not close, correct? They don't have cars, 3 days, it's gonna be long. And then he says, if you have your gift, so you're out of town, you're in Jerusalem, you're at the temple, and the gift can refer generally to anything. I mean, it could be money, it could be a sacrifice. It seems that Jesus leaves this broad and open on purpose because the gift isn't the most important thing. Here's what he says. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that who? Your brother has something against you. What do I do in this moment? How do I respond? What am I supposed to react like? Now, here's what I want to do. I want to show you a video. And I want you to pay attention very carefully to the last 10 seconds of this video, the last words that are said, and then we're going to answer this question, what do we do? Watch this.
...in Harrison, New York last week, and then this. Out of nowhere, a car flies in, crashing into the pump, and immediately starting a massive fire. The man at the pump, New York State Police senior investigator John Vesio, escaping the scene just in the nick of time.
The impact was very sudden, it was very quick.
Take a look again. Within 2 seconds, the car hits, the pump falls, and the fire erupts.
I actually went to look up and see what was going on, and next thing I knew, the pump was coming down on top of me.
Now watch as more drama unfolds. Vesio, who'd at first darted away, runs back after spotting the 70-year-old driver who'd crashed the car after suffering a diabetic shock and now could not move.
He was not responsive. I found when I got to the car, he was pretty much helpless.
Vesio struggles to get him out of the car, finally dragging him out by his shirt, only to return to the fiery scene to get a first aid kit from his car. And there wasn't a moment to spare. Take a look. Seconds later, a ball of fire consumes the car. Both men miraculously out of the danger zone.
I think John did a very heroic thing. I think he starts off as a civilian, he becomes a victim, and then his police training kicks in, and he actually saves somebody's life.
He starts off as a civilian, just a normal guy doing his normal thing. And then somebody does something to him. This is where somebody slanders you, does something really mean to you, crosses you in a way. You hear that they are frustrated with you. And then all of a sudden, in a moment, you become a victim. Because when somebody has orge or anger toward you, you don't know what they're going to do with it, do you? When somebody's in that place, do you trust the words they're going to say to their close friends? I mean, you can see how out of control this can get very quickly. But then what does it say? His training kicked in. And in this moment, Jesus is going to pause and say, your life's going to get hard. People are going to slander you. People are going to do really frustrating things to you. You're going to find out that somebody is angry with you and they are going to start gossiping about you. They're going to run after your reputation. And by the way, if you start to follow me, this is going to get more and more difficult the more righteous you live. So let me give you some tools. And this is where Village Church, you need to be trained. Because if somebody has something against you, you need to know what is your responsibility before God in terms of responding to them. And this is probably not what most people are used to doing. If you're somebody who does not like confrontation or conflict or anything difficult, the way of Jesus is going to get harder and harder for you because he's going to ask you to do impossibly difficult things. Verse 23. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, you're 3 days' journey away from home, and you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Let's just look at the verbs. The verbs actually tell us exactly what we need to do. This is training by Jesus 101. Remember. How do you remember? How do you even know? You discerned it, they told you, or someone else told you. Those are your options. Inevitably, you're going to find out. Most of you, you might think, well, how do they know? Because you wear your bitterness like on your sleeve. Most people, you don't realize that you do that, but you're very easy to read. He says this, leave your offering. And I hear your objection. He's 3 days' journey away, right? What would happen if you left some gold or sacrifice or money right there at the altar, right? And the whole point is, well, Jesus, someone's going to take it. Like, what do we do? And Jesus is like, that is the least of your worries. What does this show about the values of Jesus? Your offering or the unity of the church? One is of infinitely more value to Jesus. And so he's like, really, at this point, your offering is insignificant. It means nothing to me right now. What is most important is if you know someone's upset with you, then you have to leave it and you have to go do something, which is the third word, which means you have to go. And this is an inconvenient journey to take a 3-day journey back home, knowing you got to come back and then go back home. I mean, all in all, that's 4 3-day trips. That's a lot, right? This is not convenient. But for God, he's like, this is the most important thing to me right now. What is the urgency? Why is this such a big deal? Remember Hebrews chapter 12? Look at the end of it. Because bitterness, this untamed orge, this untamed anger, what does it do? It causes trouble and many become defiled by it. If you know someone has that and you know that it's going to defile other people, you have to go after that. Because if we lose the unity of this church, one relationship at a time, we're impotent and ineffective and useless. That's no good. He gives you another verb, be reconciled. The Apostle Paul says it this way. Love this, by the way. As far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Is it possible to be at peace with all men? What is the answer? No. As far as it depends on you, you do what you can. But Jesus, there's a strong plausibility. I'm going to take a 3-day trek back, and they're going to say to me, forget you. I don't want anything to do with you. I hate you. You fool, Raka, whatever. All right, fine. Then if that's the case, then what do I do, Jesus? You've done everything you can. Thank you. You've done everything you can. As far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. What's the next one? And then come and offer. I want to read to you Psalm 133, very short psalm. It's called a song of ascent. And this is a psalm that the Jews would read up ascending to the mountain, to the hill of Jerusalem. And they would be going up to the temple to worship. And on their way to worship, this would be the song that they would sing. A song of ascent of David. Behold, how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. Can I get an amen on that one? Like when life is peaceful and you are just at one with each other, like this is so beautiful. It's like the precious oil on the head, running down on the beard of Aaron, running down on the collar of his robes. It's like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion. For there the Lord has commanded blessing, life forevermore. He didn't just suggest blessing. He's not like, oh, it might work out. There, when you find brothers at peace and unified, the Lord blesses and life erupts. Jesus says it this way in John 17, Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be what? One. even as we are one. And as we get to the end of this passage, there's an unexpected twist, I think, here. Here's what happens in verse 25. Come to terms quickly with your what? Who is your accuser? Your brother. That interesting? Like that, your brother becomes your accuser. Come to terms quickly. Don't postpone this. The moment you see your brother has become your accuser, once you find he has something against you, your training has to kick in. While you're going with him to court, lest who? Your accuser. Hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. Why would a brother do this? What could be going on inside of a brother that could turn him into an accuser? Untamed orge, anger. That's it. It's so vile, it corrupts and defiles, and it causes otherwise, quote unquote, good men and women to do dumb things. How many of you, in the heat of bitterness, malice, and wrath, have made really wise decisions? Nor I. And this is his point. You cannot rest on their past good behavior and compliance when orge, anger, has taken root in them. Because what it does is it makes them do irrational, crazy things. And when you hear someone has something against you, you get up, you address them, you do it quickly. Because if you don't, the risk is enormous. There is no place in the church for bitterness, malice, or wrath. I want to beat the drum that Jesus beats with the same severity that he beats it. If it's in you, kill it and release it. Let the burden of your life not be, how do I tame my bitterness? But let the burden of our life be, how can I quickly approach those the moment I find out they have untamed theirs or not tamed theirs? I want to close with two questions. Number one, why is unity such a high value for Jesus? I'd like to give you an illustration. How many of you, when you go to bed at night, you leave your door unlocked and open? Anyone? Anyone? We got one. Yes. I am like that until I got married and my wife rebuked me and told me that if I loved her, that I would not do that any longer. As a dude, I didn't care. I was like, I'll be fine. It's no big deal, right? You and me, we're on the same page on this one. I love it, right? So, but I learned women generally don't like to go to sleep with the doors open and everything unlocked. How many of you, when you go to bed or you, at night, you leave your car door open and unlocked? Yeah, right? I know. I'm coming by. If I ever want to steal, I'm going to your place, basically. He's like, I'll shoot you and you'll be dead. It'll be awesome. But for the most part, people don't do that because there are certain things that you don't leave unlocked, you don't leave open, because when you do that, you're giving people an opportunity to take something that is not theirs. It's interesting because in the New Testament, there are three things that a Christian can do that leave a wide open door for Satan to influence your life, your present, your now, powerfully. The first one is from 1 Corinthians. If a husband and wife do not have a regular sexual relationship, the Apostle Paul says that basically you are opening a door up for Satan. That's one of them. Another one is when you put an elder into office when they are too young or they don't have a good reputation with unbelievers or outsiders. He could be easily puffed up, and Satan tries to find puffed up young leaders in the church to try to make them do dumb things. They're very vulnerable in that place. A marriage is vulnerable in that place. The elder team is vulnerable in that place. And then here's what we have in Ephesians chapter 4. Be angry. I mean, get angry. It's fine. Just don't sin. But here's the deal. If you're angry, do not let the sun go down on your anger. But why? Like, why do I have to deal with my irritation, frustration, aggravation, anger, like, immediately? Because here's what he says. And give no opportunity for the devil. That this is a unique moment. There are three big places in life: the leadership of the church, the institution of marriage, and our interpersonal relationships, that if we don't tend to these well, they leave wide open doors for negative influence from the evil one. Do this at your own risk, and you wonder why the tension in your marriage is growing and growing and growing, because he knows this is exactly how to negatively influence the leadership of a church, the institution of marriage, and the unity of a local church. Unresolved conflict, untamed orge, are a threat to our unity and an open door for the evil one himself, even in our midst. Question number two. But wait, wasn't Jesus angry a lot? I think yes, absolutely. And there are a lot of stories of Jesus' anger. But I want to show you one beautiful thing about his anger. In Mark chapter 10, a bunch of kids were coming to him, and the disciples were like, no, leave Jesus alone. He's too awesome for you. He's got more important things to do. Mark says that Jesus was indignant. He was furious. He rebukes the disciples, and he has the little ones come to him, and here's what Mark says, and he blessed them. It's interesting. You're going to find a regular theme in Jesus' anger. His anger results in blessing. There's another example in Mark chapter 3. Jesus is going to heal on the Sabbath. And he knows that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they have this made-up group of laws, and they make people obey them. And one of them is, you can't heal on the Sabbath. How dumb is that? Like, somebody's, if you have the ability to heal and it's Sunday, heal me, right? Or Saturday for them. And so here's what happens. Jesus is kind of provoking them. And here's what it says about his anger at them. And he, Jesus, looked around at them with anger, grieved at the hardness of their heart. Do you see that tension? But then what does he do? He healed and restored the man who needed healing. Even in his anger, it culminates in a rebuke for them, but in a blessing for someone else. We'll keep going. Remember the tables? Jesus turns them over. He's really, really, really ticked off when he does that. He's right? Well, this is the court of the Gentiles. This is a place that is reserved for non-Jews, people who don't believe in God or God-fearing Gentiles to come in and worship and offer different things. Like, this is a sacred space. And Jesus comes in and he's like, really? You have a place set aside for unbelievers and God-fearing Gentiles, and you're gonna corrupt this place and steal money from them and exploit them? And what are you doing? And what Jesus is doing is he's blessing them by giving their place back. In the process of his anger and his rebuke, there's a blessing for those people. And the Gentiles and the God-fearing Jews get to come back into their court, and they're not gonna get ripped off anymore. Jesus calls the Sadducees blind fools. You remember when he says anybody who calls his brother fool? That's literally moron. And he calls, actually, Jesus seems to break his own law, and he calls the Pharisees and Sadducees, you blind morons. He also calls them, you blind guides, you hypocrites, you whitewashed tombs, you brood of vipers. Like, do you think he said that with like a really tender spirit in that moment? Right? It's like, you're a whitewashed tomb, but I love you. You know, like, no, that's not at all what's going on. And it's interesting because right after he does this, it says that Jesus laments and that Jesus' heart is broken. And what he's doing by calling out these public teachers is blessing everyone because their teaching is leading people directly to hell. That every time Jesus is angered, it seems to be complemented with compassion and a blessing. So let me just ask the question. Does your anger bless people in your life? Awkward silence. And almost all the time, the answer is no. Somebody said, a person who is angry on the right grounds, against the right persons, in the right manner, at the right moment, and for the right length of time, deserves great praise. And this is why we worship Jesus Christ. Because he showed us what anger is and how to respond to other people's anger. He showed us how to kill resentment and bitterness. He was perfect for us. And as he gives us the Sermon on the Mount, he's putting the mirror of God's word up to each of us. And here's what it says. I am guilty. And if for somehow you get to the end of the sermon and you believe you're good, I will pray for you. And I have not done my job to the best of my ability. But I have a hard time getting to the end of any couple verses in the Sermon on the Mount and feeling good about myself because I fail them all. And this is the good news. Good people don't go to heaven, forgiven people do.